You all think Shirley was part of some group that has something to do with Beth's disappearance. His insight surprised Lundquist. I'm afraid that's not on the table for discussion. Andy is working undercover, isn't she? I can't talk about that. Would you rather have me speculating about it? In public? Lundquist shot a nasty look. It's not in the best interest of your wife or Agent Henning for you to go shooting your mouth off about a cult. A cult? I thought it was a gang. Why would you think there's a gang involved? He was about to mention Kirby Toombs, but dropped it. I don't anymore. So stop playing word games and tell me what makes the FBI think this is cult activity. Many things, most of which I'm not at liberty to delineate. Suffice it to say that certain evidence suggests to our experts that we could be dealing with some kind of group agenda that is effectuated through homicide. What do you mean, like the Manson family? Lundquist didn't respond, but he didn't have to. Gus said, My God, let's hope you're wrong. Mr. Wheatley, I don't want you to spend a lot of time worrying whether there's a cult involved in these killings. For you, the question boils down to something far more personal. Something that should perhaps help you understand why the flow of information between you and the FBI hasn't been quite what it used to be. I don't understand. You need to ask yourself the same question we're asking. Is your wife a victim, or is she an accomplice? Excuse me? You heard me. With that, the proverbial line in the sand had been drawn at his feet. Gus was suddenly glad he hadn't mentioned his talk with Kirby Toombs. If his wife was some kind of suspect, he had to be very careful about the things he told the FBI. He needed to leave before saying something he'd regret. Thank you for your candor, said Gus, rising. You're welcome. Gus started for the door, but stopped. Let me just say one thing to you and the whole damn FBI. If you think for one second that my wife had anything to do with these murders, you're out of your mind. We'll see, he said coolly. Gus glared across the office till the agent blinked. He closed the door on his way out, nearly slamming it in his wake. Chapter 50. They were somewhere in north-central Washington. Exactly where, Andy didn't know. They had traveled the last half hour without so much as a road sign. Although the trip had taken 3 hours, she sensed they were nowhere near a full 3 hours from Yakima. The journey had been circuitous. Had she wanted to turn back and go home, it would have been impossible. If she had wanted to retrace her journey 3 weeks hence, that too would have been impossible. To that extent, the meandering had a certain paranoid logic to it. It was more in the hills than the mountains. 9 rustic cabins with stone chimneys overlooked an ice-cold river that snaked between bumps on the terrain. With the first day of spring less than 2 weeks away, clusters of blue and yellow wildflowers were starting to push through the earth's brown winter crust. The ground had that spongy, thawing quality that sucked boots right off your feet. By nightfall, the hilltops would freeze over. Plenty of snow still covered the mountains in the not-too-distant background. The bus would never have made it through the back roads above the snow line. Surely, Bleckman had been aware of that when he'd promised a retreat in the mountains. A little white lie to make sure those who stayed behind were left with misinformation as to the actual destination. Andy was assigned to a cabin with 3 other women, all newcomers. 2 of them were the young women Andy had spoken to on the bus. The other was a 50-something widow named Ingrid. Andy checked for a bathroom, but there was none. The only source of water was a hand pump in the kitchen. A single outhouse for 9 cabins was in the woods near the river, mercifully downwind. The cabin had no phone or electricity, either. 3 small windows and a candle on the mantel provided the only light. The fireplace evidently worked, still holding the charred remains of someone else's fire. The beds were merely canvas cots, no mattress. They were pre-assigned, avoiding any arguments over sleeping arrangements. Everything they would need for the weekend had been laid atop their bunks and was waiting for them upon arrival. A blanket, a bar of soap, toothbrush and toothpaste, a pair of boots and set of clothes, neatly folded. They weren't new clothes, but they were clean and in good condition. They looked like the stuff Andy had been selling at the Second Chance. Some of it undoubtedly had come from there. "Everything okay?" asked Felicia as she entered the cabin. "Fine," they answered in unison. "Thanks for the extra clothes," added Andy. Felicia said, "They're not extras. They're replacements." Ingrid, the older woman, inspected a replacement sweater, probing a hole the size of a golf ball with her finger. "I kind of prefer what I brought." Felicia ignored her and handed each of them a paper shopping bag. "Change into your new clothes and stuff everything you brought with you into the bag. The welcome dinner is outside in 30 minutes. Bring the bag with you." She left without another word, closing the door behind her. The two younger women immediately started changing clothes, no questions asked. Andy and the older woman exchanged glances. "Well, I'm not putting on this ratty old stuff," said Ingrid. She was clearly looking to Andy for some show of solidarity. Andy looked away, then started peeling off her clothes and stuffing them into the bag. Gus's anger only swelled as the day went on. He suppressed it long enough to pick Morgan up from school, but by the time Carla came by to fix dinner, he needed to vent. "I'm beyond mad," he said from his seat at the kitchen table. "I'd like to kick his ass." Carla stirred the sautéed vegetables. "Geez, why didn't you think of that earlier? That will solve everything." "Fine, be sarcastic. But when Beth disappeared, the police thought I was a wife-beater who killed my wife and dumped the body. Now that they've moved beyond that theory, they think Beth is a cult member and accomplice to serial murders. I don't know why they keep treating us like criminals." "They're just being thorough, I guess, exploring every possibility." "Do you honestly think Beth could have been mixed up with a cult?" "No more than I think you're a wife-beater."
"Meaning what?"
"Nothing.
I'm tired of the little digs, Carla. I'm sorry your boyfriend used to hit you, and I feel sorry for you for having lived through it, but I'm not him, and I was never like him."
"This is not about him."
"Why do you protect the man who beat you?"
"I don't protect him."
"Yes, you do. I don't know how to explain it, but I get this feeling that all the things you wish you had said to him, you say to me. You're misdirecting your anger. Damn, sometimes I would swear you still love that guy."
She glared and said,
"Don't presume to psychoanalyze me. I was just doing what you do best, blaming people for their own misfortune so you don't have to help them."
"What are you talking about?"
"There are a lot of brothers who look out for their sisters, who aren't so wrapped up in themselves, who wouldn't have been so quick to believe that all those black eyes and bruises came from falling off a horse."
He wasn't sure that was fair. But if laying the guilt on him was a way of putting her own past behind her, so be it.
"I'm sorry. Just forget it."
"No, you have a point.
Based on no evidence at all, I haul off and suggest my sister still loves the guy who beat her. Yet in the same breath, I'm outraged at the cops for twisting the evidence about my wife."
"I wouldn't worry about Beth being accused. That's just one of many theories, I'm sure.
But once the cops get it in their heads that maybe she's a willing participant in some cult murders, the danger is they'll start looking for evidence to support their theory. If they don't see what they want to see, they'll cross their eyes, squint, stand on their heads. They'll look at it in every way imaginable until they see it in a light that supports their theory."
Carla lowered the burner to simmer and covered the saucepan.
"Well, for Beth's sake, I hope you're wrong about that."
"I'm not wrong. And the real shame is that I'd love to tell them all the things Shirley's lawyer told me."
"What kind of things?"
"That the real target of the conspiracy to commit murder wasn't a homeless person, but her own mother. That her unnamed accomplices were possibly gang members. The gang theory sounds even more interesting now that the FBI is talking about a cult. But if I mention it now, you know what will happen.
What?
Think about it. If I give them inside information about Shirley's conspiracy to commit murder, they'll probably think Beth was one of Shirley's unnamed accomplices.
Carla shot a look across the kitchen, then returned to cooking. It was a brief exchange, but Gus seemed to know what she was thinking.
I have to do this, don't I, Carla?
Do what?
If I'm going to debunk the FBI's suspicions about Beth, the first thing I have to do is prove she wasn't part of Shirley's little group.
I didn't say you had to do anything.
You didn't have to. It was the darkness of a new moon. Miles away from the glow of city lights, just an hour past sunset seemed like the dead of night. With each passing moment, another cluster of stars seemed to emerge in the ocean of blackness overhead. Andy, Ingrid, and their two younger roommates walked together from their cabin to the camp area near the river. As instructed, they had their paper shopping bags with them, filled with their belongings. It was a large campfire with flames that reached eye level. The group was seated around it, just close enough to bask in its glow and feel its warmth. They eagerly expanded the circle to make room for the newcomers. Andy didn't see Bleckman among the group. The meal had begun without him. No one was talking. The group was taking its cue from Felicia and the other lieutenants, as Andy had labeled them. As long as the honchos ate in silence, so would everyone else. Several baskets of food were passed around. Andy watched and imitated Felicia. The drill was to take something from each basket as it passed, place it on a big cloth napkin on the ground before you, and eat at your own pace. Andy took one of everything, leaving her with an assortment of delicacies. She first ate the smoked salmon, which was more like jerky than the delicacies served in restaurants. The dried berries were tasty, left over from last summer. The meat, some kind of stringy and pungent game, she left for last. She tried something that resembled a cookie, somewhat sweet but very dry. "It's a camas root cake," said Felicia, breaking the silence. She had been watching Andy pick over her food.
"It's good," said Andy.
"Camas root is the bulb of lilies indigenous to this area. It has been a natural source of nourishment for peoples of the land for thousands of years."
"How do you make them?"
"The roots are dug from the ground and baked in an oven over well-heated stones. Then you pound them till the mass is as fine as cornmeal, knead them into cakes, and dry them in the sun."
"Sounds like a lot of work."
"You'll have help."
Andy realized she'd just been volunteered. Felicia asked, "Who wants to help Kara make the camas cakes for tomorrow's meal?"
Andy's eager young roommates thrust their hands into the air.
"Very good," said Felicia. "Ingrid, how about you? Care to make it a project for your whole cabin?"
The older woman hedged.
"Oh, I'm not much of a cook, I'm afraid."
"Then you can gather the roots," she said reprovingly. Ingrid nodded nervously.
"Whatever you say."
Andy leaned toward her and said quietly,
"It's okay if you don't want to."
The older woman smiled awkwardly and whispered,
"She seemed a lot nicer at the sign-up."
They ate in silence for several minutes more. When the last among them had finished, the baskets were passed around again to gather the leftovers. A young woman collected the baskets and took them away. At Felicia's direction, a man stoked the fire and added a few more logs. Finally, Felicia rose to address the group.
"We have 6 newcomers with us tonight, and the principal purpose of tonight's banquet is to welcome all of you. We don't have a secret handshake or password or anything like that. None of us is big on ceremonies and rituals. But there is one tradition that has developed over time. This is something we have done on the first night of every retreat for as long as I can remember. It does have a certain symbolic significance. But more important, it will put each of you in the proper frame of mind to get the most out of this retreat. At this time, I would ask each of the newcomers to please stand."
Andy and the others rose. Ingrid was at her side. Her other two roommates were down to her right.
Two men were standing on the opposite side of the fire. Felicia continued, "Each of you heard Steve Bleckman's speech earlier this week. Obviously, it touched you in some way, or you wouldn't be here tonight. But none of us is here simply to be moved or inspired. We're here to be transformed. If you listen to Steve carefully, you understand that to be transformed, you must rid yourself of the worldly things that bind you. When you arrived this afternoon, each of you was given everything you will need for the weekend. You placed everything you had brought with you in a paper bag. Did you bring those bags with you?" One of the men answered yes. The others just nodded. "Ingrid?" said Felicia. The older woman started. "Place your bag in the fire." Ingrid clutched it like the payroll.
"You want me to burn my things?"
"Yes." Her eyes darted nervously. She was suddenly digging into her bag.
"Well, okay, I guess, but let me get my wallet."
"Burn it," she said firmly. "Burn everything you brought with you."
"But I have credit cards and photographs."
"Burn them." She froze. All eyes were upon her.
"I don't want to be difficult, but..."
"Ingrid, throw the bag in the fire."
"At least let me keep the pictures of my husband."
"You mustn't cling to the things of this world."
"They're my memories. They're all I have."
"They're all you'll ever have. Be seated." Ingrid was shaking, seeming to shrink as she returned to her seat. Andy wanted to go to her and tell her not to be intimidated, that she'd done the right thing. But now wasn't the time.
"Kira?"
said Felicia. Andy looked alert. "Will you take the first step?" Andy could feel the gaze of the group turn toward her. She hated to make Ingrid feel even more like an outcast, but she knew what she had to do. She took her bag, stepped forward, and pitched it into the fire. The flames shot higher as they consumed all of Kira's belongings. The group seemed transfixed by the ceremonial burning. Andy stepped back, her task complete.
"Wait,"
said Felicia. Andy halted and looked up inquisitively. Felicia said,
"The ring."
"What?"
"The ring on your finger. You brought that with you, didn't you?"
"Yes, but..." "It has to go." Andy hesitated. The struggle wasn't staged.
"Kira, it must go. Feed the fire."
With some obvious reluctance, she pulled the ring from her finger, held it for a moment, and then tossed it into the flames. Felicia smiled. She clapped her hands, and the entire group promptly applauded her. One by one, each of them rose from their place in the circle and stepped forward to embrace her. Warm, full embraces, each one taking a full 10 seconds or more. They said nothing, but their actions said it all. Nothing she had ever done in her life had earned her such immediate acceptance and approval. When the last had embraced her, she faced Felicia. She smiled with her eyes, but she did not rise to embrace her. The clear implication was that a newcomer had to travel much further to gain the praise of the inner circle.
"Welcome, Kira," she said simply.
Andy gave a quick nod and returned to her seat. She listened as Felicia called out the name of the next newcomer, but she was so fixated on the fire that their voices faded behind the hissing and crackling of logs. She stared at the dancing yellow flames, searching helplessly for the ring. It wasn't just any piece of jewelry. It was a very special ring. Hidden inside was the tiny electronic tracking transmitter that Isaac Underwood had insisted she carry for her own safety. And now it was incinerated. Kira had won acceptance, but Andy was truly on her own. Chapter 51. Gus called his investigator at home early Saturday morning. Dex was on his way out the kitchen door, fishing pole in hand. It was his first weekend off in months, and he had planned to make the most of it.
Gus had other ideas. I need you to find Shirley Borges' mother for me. Naturally, he wanted to know why, and Gus explained in less than a minute. Dex said, As I recall from Shirley's polygraph results, she didn't even know her mother was still alive.
That's true, but if she is, I want to talk to her.
Is the FBI looking for her?
They don't even know she was the real target of Shirley's conspiracy to commit murder. That was something Shirley's lawyer told me. If I shared any of that with the FBI, they'd have Beth tagged as one of her unnamed co-conspirators.
You think your wife could have been?
No, he said harshly.
Dex was silent, as if giving his client time to think about it.
No way, said Gus, this time a little less firmly.
It's all right. This isn't the first time someone has hired me to find out if a spouse is really involved in a crime rather than sharing their information with the police.
That's not what I'm doing.
You may not realize it, but that is what you're doing.
You're starting to make me mad.
Don't be mad at me. Don't be mad at the FBI either. With that phone call from Beth, her shoplifting and her clothes found in a thrift store where Agent Henning is working undercover, it seems plausible that a cult or a gang could have played a role in these murders, and that Beth might be involved.
Beth couldn't hurt anyone.
She could have played a more passive role. She is an attractive woman.
What does that have to do with anything?
I'm just talking hypothetically here. Remember the serial killer's first two victims were men, killed in their homes. No sign of forced entry at the second one. Sending an attractive woman to the door is a good way to catch a man off guard. Get inside. I've used that ruse myself. Hired myself an attractive cocktail waitress who pretends her car broke down, knocks on some guy's door, and asks to borrow the phone. Once inside, she plants a bug for me.
You're saying Beth is the one who opened the door for a serial killer?
All I'm saying is that she doesn't have to strangle someone with her own hands to be involved in these killings.
Yet another possibility, said Gus. Someone wants the police to think she's an accomplice. He's planting evidence of Beth's involvement, like that phone call to Morgan.
But why?
I don't know. Maybe to throw the cops off the track. Maybe to make the FBI think they should be looking for a cult in Yakima when they should be chasing down Shirley's little gang in Seattle. That's just one more thing I have to find out.
You want me to tackle that one?
I just want you to find Shirley's mother. Can you do that fast?
Piece of cake.
Call me when you do, said Gus.
It was an unusually warm Saturday afternoon for early March. The valley had been in winter's icy grip since Thanksgiving, but over the last week or so, temperatures had been steadily rising in anticipation of spring. The humming of lawnmowers could be heard in the nearby town of Sela, the first cut of the year. It was time to store away the snowmobiles till next season, a good day to leave the jacket inside and feel the warmth on your skin. It was Flora's first day out of the house in more than a week. There was always plenty of work to do around the farm, and today was no exception. 200 newly hatched chicks had been delivered to the coop last week. In 6 weeks, the pullets would be grown and tender and ready for slaughter. This afternoon, her job was menial but necessary. In a way, it was even philosophical. They called it culling. Every delivery of chicks included some infirm ones. It wasn't wise to wait for the weak to infect the strong. Every day, someone had to walk down to the coop, select the weaklings, and snap their necks. As cliched as it sounded, it really was all in the wrist. The fuzzy little body fit easily in one hand. A little squirming, a few innocent chirps. With one quick jerk, it was all over. She had hated it at first, but had grown accustomed to it. It wasn't so much the killing that had bothered her anymore. It was the odor. Nothing smelled worse than a chicken coop. To her credit, she could at least come and go without holding her nose, a vast improvement over her first visit to the compound more than a year ago. Of course, it wasn't the thought of raising chickens or picking apples that had drawn her there. It was the typical laundry list of personal problems. Trouble at home, an unhappy marriage,
a husband who had become a stranger. She had attended dozens of Enlightenment workshops and lectures, none of which had lasted more than a day. Over time, she had found herself drawn to a different kind of family, to the group's teachings. Working in the orchards or tending to the farm was therapeutic, though she had never honestly planned on staying. Now, leaving was out of the question. "Flora?" The man's voice echoed from the farmhouse. He was standing on the back porch nearly a quarter mile away. She didn't answer. He called again, this time more sternly. "Flora!" The second time it hit her. He was calling her. Despite the drilling, she wasn't used to her new name yet. Quickly and without a word, she tossed the last of the dead culls into her basket and obediently started toward the house. This was the part she'd dreaded. She knew the pattern by now. Every time he gave her something like free time, he laid another burden on her. The burden of guilt. Her steps grew heavier as she crossed the yard, knowing what to expect when she returned to her room. The photographs. The innocent victims. More mind games to play on her conscience. Those women had been strangers to her at one time. By now, however, she knew their names, their faces, and every detail of their horrible deaths. Most disturbing of all, she knew there would be more. That much was clear from what he had told her all along. "Only you have the power to stop it, Flora. It's in your hands." With her head down, she climbed the back steps and entered the house, feeling anything but power, feeling like anyone but Flora. Andy was exhausted. They had spent the morning digging for camas roots to make cakes. At this higher elevation, the ground was frozen in spots, half-frozen in others, which made it a chore. Still, they had managed to pull out more than 8 bushels with their long, hooked knives. They were quite an efficient tool. Andy couldn't help but wonder how efficient they might be as a weapon. By late afternoon, her knuckles ached from pounding the roots into meal with large stones. She and her roommates had shaped the meal into cakes until it became almost mechanical. By mid-afternoon, the cakes were drying in the sun. Felicia came by and gave her approval. Ingrid and Andy's 2 younger roommates went back to the cabin to clean up. She held Andy back to talk. "You're a good worker," said Felicia. "All 4 of us worked hard." "Not really. The girls think this is just fun. Ingrid, I'm surprised she lasted all day. But you have the seriousness of purpose that we like." "Thank you." She invited Andy to sit on the ground atop a blanket of dried leaves. Facing one another, Felicia asked, "Why are you here?" "You mean on this earth or at this retreat?" Felicia smiled. "I like the way you think. At this retreat." Andy sensed she was being quizzed. She wanted to give the right answers. "I'm here to learn more about your group." "What have you found out so far?" She checked her battered hands. "That getting back to the source can cause blisters." "What else?" Andy turned more serious. "That whatever it takes, it's worth it." "How do you know that?" "I have good instincts." "Congratulations, Kira. You've taken the first step, learning to trust your instincts." "What's the next step?" "That is something that will come to you in the normal course, after you have focused your energy." "How do I focus?" "Through meditation and reflection." "What do I reflect on?" She was staring into Andy's eyes, but it was more of a warm gaze than a cold glare. "Let me tell you something about us. We are not about comets or the passing of the millennium or other such things that have driven the hundreds of ufology groups that have come and gone in recent times. We don't believe that a spaceship is going to come down to Earth and take us all to the next level beyond human. By changing our own level of vibration, We strive for a connection with a higher source, which requires an emotional disconnection from the negative energy that keeps us on the wrong life paths. Where does that negative energy come from? Frankly, the usual source is the traditional family, a controlling parent, a manipulative spouse. But for each individual, it's different. You must analyze and reflect on the sources of negative energy in your own life.
It sounded as though Felicia were fishing for something about Andy's past. She had her phony background memorized, but the more she talked, the higher the risk of eventually being caught in inconsistencies. Andy answered vaguely.
That sounds like a very insightful way of thinking.
Yes, but I assure you, it is utterly impossible to identify the true source of negative energy in your life if you return to your same old environment.
That's logical. One has to step back in order to be objective.
That's exactly the opportunity I'm offering you.
I don't understand. The retreat ends tomorrow. Most of the newcomers will return home. They will never evolve beyond their present selves. But you are different, Kira.
How so?
We'd like you to stay with us. Come back to the farm and continue your journey.
What about the others?
Don't worry about the others. You have been chosen, not them.
I don't know what to say.
She squeezed her hand.
Say yes.
Andy hesitated, not wanting to appear overeager.
Okay, I accept.
Of course you do.
Her tone was matter-of-fact, as if yes were the only acceptable answer.
Thank you, Felicia.
Don't thank me. Thank Steve.
I'm not sure I know how.
You will learn, she said in the same flat tone. That I can promise you.
Chapter 52. The bus returned to Yakima early Sunday morning. Of the six newcomers, Andy and one of the men, the aspiring lounge musician, were the only ones invited back to the farm. The others were dropped at the parking lot where they had left their cars on Friday. The bus would leave for the farm in 15 minutes, just a short break to give everyone time to use the bathroom after the 3-hour ride back to the city. Andy knew she had to make a phone call before they reached the farm. Her supervisors hadn't authorized an undercover assignment beyond the weekend. She considered just going to the payphone and calling, but she didn't want the others to get suspicious. She pulled Felicia aside to be upfront with her in an undercover way.
I have to call my mother, said Andy. I told her I was going away just for the weekend. If she doesn't hear from me, she'll worry.
Why call her?
Like I said, she'll be worried. Heck, who knows, she might even call the police and report me missing.
I understand. Whenever we invite a newcomer back to the farm, we encourage them to notify their family of their decision for precisely that reason. But phone calls can be problematic. We prefer that you simply write a letter.
You don't know my mother, said Andy. She'll never believe this was my decision if she just gets a letter in the mail. She'll want to hear it straight from my own mouth.
Felicia shot a judgmental look, as if to say that Andy's mother was one of those controlling family members with negative energy who needed to be eliminated.
All right. Call her if you must, but be strong. Do not let her talk you out of something that you know is right.
Thank you.
Andy started for the payphone across the street.
Kira, she called, stopping her. Tell her you won't be calling home again. Tell her that if she hears from you again, it will be by letter.
I will,
she said, then continued toward the phone. The phone rang at the Underwood residence. Isaac was in the kitchen with his daughter, cooking breakfast and watching Sesame Street. It was one of his 2 weekends a month, one of just 2 dozen annual opportunities to prove that divorced men can do Sunday morning pancakes. He lowered the volume on the TV and took the call while attending to the griddle. It was Andy, which relieved him. The word from his technical agents that the transmitter in Andy's ring had been stationary all weekend had worried him. Andy explained the ceremonial burning and more, glancing every now and then toward the bus to make sure no one could overhear. Isaac said, "What you're saying blends with the updated profile from Quantico. What does Santos think now? She's getting back to the fact that all of the victims display wounds consistent with personal cause homicides. The killer is acting out of personal anger against the victim. The killings may not be random, as Santos had originally thought. The killer, or killers, may have a very specific agenda. That's especially interesting when you're talking about a cult. Which is why I need to stay on this assignment." "What?" "I'm sorry not to run this through the usual channels, but the fact is, I have just one phone call. My contact agent doesn't have the authority to extend my assignment, and Lundquist's balls are barely big enough to get him into the men's room. So what do you say?" "How long?" "As long as it takes." The pancakes were burning. Isaac snatched up the griddle and dumped the smoldering mess into the sink. "Andy, as long as there's a threat of a serial killer making another hit, you're going to have to move fast. Normally, I'd say take some time to build contacts. In this case, you're going to have to be aggressive, which means you could blow your own cover."
"I understand."
"I don't think you do, not fully. You know that videotape you bought at Bleckman's orientation meeting? I sent it out for analysis by an audio expert, specifically a psychological stress evaluator. I was under the impression the Bureau didn't use PSEs. I had a few of them done when I was with Seattle PD, and I thought it might be right in this circumstance. You're familiar with the test, then?"
"Yeah, it measures variations and tremors in voice patterns that are inaudible to the human ear."
"Right. In fact, the machine actually charts the variations and creates a kind of voice print, which is what I did with your tape. We had a voice print created for Bleckman and also for Felicia and Tom, the two lieutenants who spoke at the meeting."
"What did you find?"
"Bleckman is off by himself, which is normal. He's the leader. It's Tom and Felicia who are interesting. They have almost an identical voice print. The expert could barely tell them apart."
"What does the expert make of that?"
"Two possibilities," said Isaac. "One, these characters are skilled actors who are delivering a very well-rehearsed pitch in a very controlled and identical manner.
Or
they are programmed exactly alike. I mean, exactly. Someone has done a real mind control number on them."
"Someone named Bleckman."
"I'm not trying to scare you, Andy. I say this only because, well, you know why."
"Do I?"
"I think you do." She smiled, but it was strained. "Boy, is this not the time."
"I'll watch my back. Don't worry."
"Well, since you don't have eyes in the back of your head, I'm going to set up spot surveillance around the farm. It won't be 24 hours, but it's still too expensive to run this forever. I want you to check in with me no later than Wednesday. Just somehow get yourself to a phone. If I don't hear from you, I'm pulling the plug." Isaac sensed her hesitation, as if she were suddenly distracted, perhaps being watched.
"It won't be easy," she said finally. "But I promise I'll stay in touch."
It was one of those mornings that Gus felt like going straight back to bed and staying there. Not the typical lazy Sunday morning with a cup of coffee and the Post-Intelligencer. More like Sunday, the 2-week anniversary of Beth's disappearance. Martha Goldstein's timing was a piece of work. A letter hand-delivered to his house on the very day she knew he would be at an emotional low.
"Dear Gus," it read, "I know you're busy with other things, but could you please make time to come into the office this week to assist in the orderly transfer of your files?"
What a manipulator. The message was handwritten on her personal stationery rather than typed on the firm's letterhead, as if that would disguise the fact that it was purely a cover-your-ass letter, designed to put Gus on legal notice that if anything slipped through the cracks while he was out searching for his wife, his professional neck was on the line, not hers. Nice touch, Martha. You forgot to draw in the smiley face under your signature. In the big picture, he knew that the orderly transfer of files was one more step toward his permanent removal as managing partner and eventual break with Preston and Coolidge. The same thing had happened 5 years ago when he had taken the helm and sent his successor packing. It would be best if he just resigned. Less embarrassment for the old manager and fewer hassles for the new. The thought of dragging things out sickened him. Knowing he'd have to endure the slow parade of partners who would stop by his office, tell him he'd gotten screwed, tell him they admired his fight, and then ask for dibs on his office. The distastefulness of it all had Gus yearning for a clean break. This was his chance to realize one of his oldest dreams, something he would never have found the nerve to try unless forced to do it, starting his own law firm. Now that was a professional dream worth his sweat. Just as soon as he found Beth. The phone rang. It was his investigator, Dex.
I found Shirley's mother.
Gus was suddenly over the law firm.
Dead or alive?
Most definitely alive, about an hour's drive from here. More the sticks than the suburbs. If you want, I can pay her a visit today, see if she'll talk.
No, said Gus. I'll do it myself.
You sure?
Yeah, he said as he hopped out of bed. I'm sure.
Chapter 53. The farm was on 12 acres that looked like 100. It was surrounded by open prairie, and had it not been for the barbed wire fencing, its boundaries would have been indiscernible. A long and dusty driveway led to a barn large enough to hold the old school bus, a tractor, 2 cars, and 9 horses. Adjacent to it was a white 2-story frame house. It was old but freshly painted and well-maintained, its original Victorian-style details still intact. On the other side of the barn were a dozen small boxy-looking units with aluminum siding. They reminded Andy of a minimum security prison. The bus pulled straight into the barn. The group filed off and walked toward the smaller living quarters. None went to the main farmhouse.
Come on, said Felicia. Let me show you around.
Andy followed her on a brief walking tour. To the east was a 5-acre orchard, apples and apricots. The trees had been pruned in hat-rack fashion, but spring buds were emerging. A vegetable garden covered another 2 acres. Felicia mentioned a variety of spring vegetables, but it was too early to tell what had been planted there. The animals were around back. A chicken coop was all the way against the back fence, its odor well away from the main house. A half dozen horses and cows were munching grass along the fence line. They kept a healthy distance from the wire. Andy noted the electrodes. It was electrified. They continued down past the chickens to a pond and a stand of trees. Behind the trees, Andy noticed a small rectangular building.
What's that? She asked.
We can't go there, said Felicia.
Why not?
We're not ready. It's a special place for meetings and ceremonies. Only the members who have reached the highest level can go there.
Even you can't go there? Asked Andy.
You think I'm the highest level? She asked, amused.
Far from it, girl. I have a long way to go.
How many levels are there?
You pass through as many levels as are necessary to purge yourself of the human irritations, frustrations, and anxieties that must be overcome to reach beyond the human realm.
So it's different for each person?
Yes, because we all come here with different baggage.
Remember, the ultimate goal is to physically change your level of vibration so that you can receive the flow of energy directly from the source.
Everyone has different circumstances that keep them vibrating at a human level. Some people are married, some have children, some just live in the past, thinking about what they used to be like when they were 18 or 20 or 35. Your attachment to other people or even to your own past will keep you from evolving.
You mean I have to forget who I was?
Absolutely.
Andy took a breath.
That's quite a commitment.
Yes. And each level you attain brings additional commitments.
What kind of commitments?
You'll see.
How long does it take?
No set time frame. When you're ready to move up, he will know, and he will tell you. He? Stephen Bleckman, of course. Oh, of course. Come on, Kira. Let me show you to your room.
Felicia led her back to the plain barracks on the far side of the barn. Each of the 12 units looked exactly alike. Felicia took her to the last unit, farthest from the barn. The door had no lock, but it was stuffy inside, as if it hadn't been lived in for some time. 4 bunks lined the wall. Clothes and other essentials were laid out on the bed, just as they had been at the cabin on the retreat. There was a bathroom, though it wasn't much bigger than the closet beside it. The thought of sharing this space with 3 other women didn't thrill Andy.
It will be just the 2 of us for a week or so, said Felicia.
We're living together?
Everyone gets a partner when they first arrive. It's my job to help you through.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
She gestured toward the bathroom.
Maybe you'd like to clean up a little?
I'd love a shower.
There's a towel in the bathroom. Feel free.
The shower stall was small, but Andy didn't care. A hot shower was the closest thing to normal she'd experienced in 3 days. She ran it until the hot water was gone, which wasn't long, less than 2 minutes. It was on a timer to keep her from overindulging. Andy stepped out and toweled off. She stood and faced what should have been the mirror, that space right above the sink, but there was none. She stepped out wrapped in a towel. Felicia was seated on the bed. Laid out atop the towel resting on the bed were a brush, a comb, and scissors.
Did you know there's no mirror in here? Said Andy. We don't have any.
No mirrors?
Come, sit here.
Andy seated herself on the bed. Felicia said, How you see yourself is not important. She started combing Andy's hair in a way Andy had never combed it, parting it on the wrong side.
What matters is how he sees you. We groom each other in the way that pleases him.
Andy froze as her new partner reached for the scissors. She wanted to protest, but she quelled her instincts. She had to submit. Kira would submit.
Are you saying every woman who comes here has changed her appearance? Every woman and every man.
The thought chilled her. She had looked carefully, but perhaps not carefully enough. It was entirely possible that she had already seen Beth Wheatley and not recognized her. Then again, maybe she was one of those less accessible members at the higher level. With a snip of the scissors, long strands of wet hair began falling to the floor. The pea-gravel driveway was empty at the home of Meredith Borge, and no one answered when Gus knocked at the door. He had decided against an advance call for fear that she might not want to see him. He thought it best to catch her cold. Meredith lived in a rural area at the end of a gravel road, just one of 2 houses on the entire route. The driveway was rather ill-defined, just 2 dirt ruts in the ground that cut across the lawn and ended at the front porch. Gus parked near the culvert at the turnaround at the end of the road and waited. Through a thin stand of pine trees, he could see the house clearly. An hour passed, and not a single car came or went. The rain started and stopped a dozen times before a 20-year-old pickup truck finally pulled into the driveway. A woman stepped down and walked up the pathway. She appeared to be in her 40s, slim and brunette, right in line with Dex's description. Gus jumped out of his car. Mrs. Borge? She stopped and turned but did not respond. Her suspicious gaze stopped Gus in his tracks.
Excuse me for bothering you, he said, but I'd like to talk to you about your daughter.
I don't have a daughter.
I know, I'm sorry about her death.
You are? Why?
My name's Gus Wheatley. My wife disappeared 2 weeks ago today. Your daughter and I were involved in some discussions about her possible whereabouts before she died.
Her stare was ice cold.
I have nothing to say to you.
Mrs. Borge, please.
Gus followed her halfway up the front steps, but her glare only intensified.
get off my property before I call the police. It's important that we talk, please. Just a minute of your time.
She unlocked the door. For an instant, it seemed she was about to say something, more nervous than hostile.
Please, said Gus. Do us both a favor. Go away.
She stepped inside and slammed the door, leaving Gus alone on the front porch. Andy hadn't eaten since early Saturday afternoon, but there was no breakfast or lunch on the Sunday menu. On the retreat, they had kept her up late and woken her early, allowing her little more than 7 hours of total sleep since Thursday. Rest, however, was not on Sunday's schedule either. Felicia was her constant companion. Neither one of them left the unit. They spent hours together sitting on the floor, eyes closed and legs crossed. Felicia taught her several breathing exercises to help her relax and meditate. Every half hour or so, she would ask Andy to join her in repeating 3 times aloud, I am going to rise above and overcome my human desires and activities and transform my being into something more than physical. They had no other conversation. The goal was to channel Andy's thoughts and energy. Her thoughts were definitely focused, though all Andy could think was, what in the hell have I gotten myself into? By late afternoon, sitting in the same posture had left her legs cramped and her knees on the verge of explosion. She had already passed the hunger stage when Felicia announced it was time to eat. They didn't have to leave the room. Felicia opened the door, and a tray with 2 Camas cakes was waiting on the doorstep, seemingly on cue. Felicia took one and offered the other to Andy. She ate, neither quickly nor slowly, matching Felicia bite for bite. When they finished, Felicia again led her in the same chant. I am going to rise above and overcome. Andy joined her. She could hear herself speaking, but no longer felt her mouth moving. The light in the room suddenly gave way to a black buzzing. She felt dizzy and disoriented. In the background, she heard Felicia's voice, but it was the very distant background. Andy focused, as if the words from Felicia's mouth were her lifeline back to reality, as if she could see herself climbing hand over hand from the dark, swirling hole. Finally, the dizziness passed. She was shaking, but coherent. Her eyes opened. Felicia was staring at her, checking her out. Andy could still feel the tingling in her fingertips. That was no ordinary camas cake. Or had she simply experienced a breakthrough? It's time, said Felicia. For what? Your meeting with Stephen Blackman.
One-on-one?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, am I ready?
Yes.
I'm so nervous.
Don't be, said Felicia. The first meeting is the same for everyone.
What happens?
He just gives you a lie detector test. Andy rose, feigning eagerness, hiding her true feelings. Now, what do I do? Chapter 54. Gus had waited outside Mrs. Borge's house for only 90 seconds before realizing he didn't need a stalking charge piled upon his alleged spouse abuse. She had told him to get lost and seemed to have meant it. A failure, he drove away reluctantly to think through his options. Once home, it was immediately obvious that he wasn't the only one haunted by the fact that this Sunday afternoon marked 2 weeks since Beth had dropped off Morgan for tumbling class and disappeared. Gus needed to get his daughter out of the house. The Sonics were in town, and Gus had season tickets that he routinely gave away to clients and rarely used for himself. Morgan was more into soccer than basketball, but it turned out to be a pretty effective way of keeping her focused on something other than Beth. The same could not be said for Gus. His mind was barely on the game. It ended with a Sonics victory, which left the fans in an upbeat mood on the way out of the stadium. Gus carried Morgan through the heavy foot traffic, but she wanted to walk once they got outside.
He led her by the hand as they flowed with 1,000 others to the parking garage across the street.
That was fun, Daddy.
Yeah, we'll do it again soon. Their car was just ahead. No sooner had these words left his lips than he noticed the ticket on his windshield. He swallowed several bad words in Morgan's presence, wondering what horrible offense the traffic Gestapo had nailed him for, parking too close to the line, forgetting to straighten his wheels, failing to run over the visiting team's fans. He put Morgan in the back seat and checked his prize beneath the wiper. It wasn't a ticket at all. It was a note, much like the pizza flyers and other junk he'd often discarded without even reading. This one, however, caught his attention. His name was written on the outside. He opened it and froze. "Stay away from Meredith Borge, or I end up like her daughter." Icicles ran up his spine. He scanned the garage instinctively, as if whoever had placed it there might actually be stupid enough to hang around and watch him read it. He saw only happy Sonics fans on their way to their cars. Carefully, he placed the note in his jacket and got in the car.
"What was that, Daddy?"
"What was what?"
"That thing on our windshield?"
He had to gather his wits to answer, still shaken. "It was just nothing, really."
"Why did you keep it?"
"Because there's no garbage can. I'll throw it out when we get home."
"Can we stop for ice cream on the way?"
"Not tonight, sweetie. We have ice cream at home. Daddy has to get back." Gus wasn't sure if he should call the police or his investigator. He had to do something, but not in front of Morgan. He merged aggressively into traffic. With a little attitude behind the wheel, he could have them home in 15 minutes. As they cruised up I-5, Gus dissected the note in his mind, particularly the last part, "Or I end up like her daughter." Surely Borge had committed suicide. Why would his discussions with Meredith Borge prompt another suicide? Or maybe that was the point. Shirley's death had not been a suicide.
"Daddy, can I get a cat?"
He checked her in the rearview mirror. A couple of years back, Morgan had asked for one. The answer had been no. "We can't get a cat, remember? Your mother's allergic."
"Are you allergic?"
"No."
"Is Aunt Carla allergic?"
"No."
"Then why can't we have one now?"
She was testing him to see if he thought her mother was really coming back. If he hadn't been so distracted, if the whole damn situation hadn't been so sad and pathetic, he would have thought she was a pretty clever kid. "Morgan, if we get a cat, we would just have to get rid of it when your mother comes home." She wasn't satisfied. She knew her trick had been foiled. The iron gate at the end of the driveway opened, and the car pulled up to their house. Once inside, Morgan went to her room. Gus went straight for the telephone. The red light on his answering machine was blinking. One message. He hit the play button.
"This is Meredith Borge calling for Gus Wheatley."
There was a long pause. Gus moved closer to the machine as if willing her to continue. Finally, she said,
"Meet me in the coffee shop at the Red Lion Hotel by the airport at 8 o'clock tonight. Just you. I got no interest in talking to the police."
More silence. Then the digital voice announced, "End of messages." It was a cryptic message, all the more eerie on the heels of the note on his windshield. Gus wasn't sure what to make of the pair. Bizarre coincidence? Some kind of setup? He checked his watch. Not quite 6. Plenty of time to drive out to the airport and meet her. Car keys in hand, he picked up the phone and called his investigator.
"Dex, we need to meet. Someone left a note on my windshield this afternoon. It's signed by someone named Flora, but I'd swear it's Beth's handwriting."
This ends Disc 9, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 10.
Chapter 55. The chill of night had covered the valley, yet Andy felt numb to the cold as Felicia led her to the main farmhouse. It was either the fortified camas cake or the apprehension over the lie detector test. Or both. Andy knew polygraphs could be beaten. The problem was, she wasn't sure she could beat one. They walked around to the back of the house and stopped at the cellar doors. They weren't actually going inside the house. It was off-limits to the likes of Felicia, and certainly Andy. Those were the rules, she knew. But that didn't take the edge off the thought of being trapped in the basement with a possible serial killer. Felicia opened the cellar doors. "He's waiting for you." It was one of those defining moments for an undercover agent. Andy hadn't been at it nearly long enough to know when to step out of role and run for it.
"Are you coming with me?"
Felicia shook her head.
"Just you and Stephen."
Andy glanced down the dark cement staircase, then back at Felicia.
"Wish me luck."
"There's no such thing as luck, Kira."
"Then why do I feel so shit out of it?" thought Andy. She started the climb down into the cellar. The instant she reached the bottom stair, the door closed behind her. Total darkness. She waited for the eyes to adjust, but there was no adjustment to the complete absence of light. Her heart raced. She was about to make a dash for the doors, somewhere up the stairs behind her. Then a light switched on. Stephen Bleckman was standing just 3 feet in front of her. She started, nearly panicked.
"Welcome," he said, as he extended a hand.
She struggled to bring her adrenaline under control.
"You scared me."
"There's nothing to be scared of."
"Easy for you to say."
"Yes, it is. Fear is a human bondage I shed long ago."
"I guess I'm not quite on your level yet."
"That's okay. You're learning."
He took a half step closer, again offering his hand.
"Come."
Andy met his gaze. Funny, but he didn't have yellow eyes, blazing eyes, eyes that glowed in the dark. He looked just like a normal guy.
"Where are we going?"
"Nowhere. We're staying right where we are."
"Do we have to do this down here? It's kind of cold."
"You're nervous," he said with a half smile.
"Wouldn't you be?"
"Sure, everyone is."
"So Felicia was right? You give everyone a lie detector test?"
"Absolutely." Andy looked around. The lighting from the lone bulb hanging from the ceiling was dim at best. Still, Andy could see everything in the cellar, a sump pump, a couple of old bicycles, 2 chairs, but nothing that resembled a polygraph.
"So where is your equipment?"
"My what?"
"Your polygraph equipment."
He chuckled.
"You thought I was going to hook you up to all that mechanical stuff?"
"Yeah.
I don't know of any other way to give someone a lie detector test."
"I do." Something in his response chilled her. He turned and went to one of the 2 chairs behind him.
"Sit down, Kira, and face me."
Slowly, Andy came forward. Only when she sat did she notice that her chair was a few inches higher than his, leaving them exactly at the same eye level. Bleckman stared into her eyes. Andy blinked.
"Don't look away from me," he said.
Andy met his stare. It was a penetrating gaze, as though he were looking inside her. He extended his arms toward her.
"Grab my wrists."
She reached forward and their hands interlocked. Each of them had the other by the pulse, right hand to